Australian Politics with Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, welcome back.
Hello, David. Thank you.
There was a world leader of serious note in town, the Prime Minister of Japan. What was it about? Why was she here?
Well, it has been, you know, a pretty busy diplomatic circuit for the Prime Minister over the past couple of months. We had the Canadian leader, Mark Carney, the European Commission, President Ursula von der Leyen, and then it was began to circulate that we would then see the Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, come to Australia as well. And there was a sense that in a broad decision-making position from these different countries, that there was an interest in visitation around the stability of Australia, about importance of middle power partnerships as the sands shift internationally and the United States becomes less reliable, less predictable. And I think this visit did flow into that kind of thinking, that there was a sense of importance in having a visit to Australia, the Japanese Prime Minister coming here, striking agreements and stronger ties with the Australian government around cooperation on defence, on security, on energy. And I think that's a really critical point. It's come at a time where we have this fuel crisis that, you know, is potentially coming down the line within the next couple of months. Australia is really working hard to shore up allegiances within Asia to try and ensure that there is fuel supply to Australia. That feeds directly into the decisions made around the budget too, because I think it was very welcome for the Japanese that Australia isn't going ahead with a 25% gas tax in the budget next week. Certainly a smile on the Japanese Prime Minister's face when she arrived here in Australia.
Did she thank us for making more money from our gas than we do?
Well, we didn't have any questions, David. So it was interesting in that sense. You know, there was a lot discussed and dealt with today. Apparently the meeting behind closed doors went for 80 minutes. Like, that's a serious kind of diplomatic foray. A lot of these things are organised in advance. Sometimes these meetings are seen as partly being a bit of rubber stamping around agreements and discussion, not necessarily extremely lengthy kind of discussions of this nature in the room between the two leaders, but that's what happened today. Then they came out with their joint statements, and yes, energy security and stability was referenced, the importance of reliability, of how partners treat each other, reading between the lines. You know, it wouldn't really be seen potentially as acceptable for Australia to suddenly change the taxing on gas when it's already struck the contracts that go to Japan. So I think there was certainly some oblique references, but when it came to the chance that we usually expect with other liberal democracies to ask questions, that wasn't an option. And I'm told from the Japanese side during sort of the conversations they've had with Australian journalists that she is not really that interested or keen to engage with journalists in the way that some of her predecessors have been. And even though she was part of a joint press conference with President Trump at the White House, that generally she doesn't really do interviews. She has members of her team who come and speak like a White House press secretary, but she doesn't really engage directly with the press on a regular basis.
Even in Japan?
Even in Japan. Anna, yeah, so we didn't have that opportunity, David.
Anna, so much of what you've listed sounds sort of copperplate. And I'm wondering whether it's been possible to work out, you know, more deeply what it's really about between the two leaders. I mean, 80 minutes together is not rubber stamping. But on the other hand, how much was decided in that meeting? Do you know?
It's hard to gauge exactly what was the significance. I think to backtrack a little bit, the significance of this meeting is partially in the optics to the world of these leaders coming, standing side by side, you know, striking this range of deals, talking about things which are very much directed both at the United States and China. So there was deal making today on critical minerals supply chains, for example, that is directly about saying to China, we're trying to work out a way to survive or to do things without, you know, relying on you. And then there was also deal making around safety and security in the Indo-Pacific, partially to send a message or try and send a message to the United States about the importance of this region, which the US has both been leaving in terms of capability and its attention. But also, I think speaking to a couple of the analysts who've been watching this relationship very closely, Australia and Japan are seen as two of the sort of key, powerful Indo-Pacific nations. And there is a discussion now happening about how they can attract Donald Trump's interest and attention back to the Indo-Pacific and make sure that that security and protection and defense relationship with Donald Trump, because they're both countries' allies with Donald Trump, with the US, that's really necessary. But Australia and Japan are not direct allies. We are, as the Japanese Prime Minister said today, quasi allies.
What does that mean? It sounds so patronizing.
I think from what I can gather, speaking to the press secretaries representing the Japanese government, it's not supposed to be derogatory. It's not supposed to suggest that we have a lower level of relationship. But if we were to strike a direct security relationship, that would be a really serious thing, because it could end up being something that basically mobilizes each country in each other's defense. So that would be a huge agreement to make. And I think what both sides are trying to say is that while they don't have that kind of deal that would oblige them to each other's help and all the implications of that, particularly with where Japan is situated in the world, that it is seen as an extremely close relationship and one that doesn't really exist between Japan and other nations. So a closeness and a sharing of things like intelligence and military firepower, military experience. You know, we've just struck a deal to get certain types of military warship from Japan, the Megami class frigate. That closeness of the relationship is there, but it's not formalised in a security alliance.
There's been some talk about Japan making it clear we can always go back to them for submarines. Have you heard any of that? I mean, we were buying submarines from Japan before we decided to buy submarines from France, okay, before we decided to buy submarines from America and the UK. Are they really putting up their hands and saying, you can always come back to us?
There was no sense in the formal discussions today that that's genuinely on the table. But at the same time, I think there is a level of skepticism around what can be delivered out of AUKUS and whether or not the promises and the timelines and the cost is going to continue to, you know, move and potentially blow out, and whether Australia will look at other options. So I think it's a genuine prospect to put up and discuss. But in terms of what was being discussed at the heart of today's conversation, it was not about that kind of deal or backtracking to that kind of option. This was, though, about trying to make clear that middle powers are working together, that middle powers in tandem have power in the world. And as much as it does seem like a lofty ideal, that the rules-based order that these countries have, you know, championed over many years still exists across different countries at the moment. And even though things have appeared to be falling apart in some ways in decision-making around the Middle East, Strait of Hormuz, that there are still nations that comply with and want to see that rules-based order re-established.
Anna, you know Alice Springs. What do you make of what's been happening there in the last few days?
It's just the most terrible and traumatic time for the community of Alice Springs. Kumanjai little baby and her family, their experience of having to grieve her death and how nationally public it is, and everything that is kind of going on around this process in terms of conversations about conditions in the town camps, about what's happened in Alice Springs in the aftermath. I think we've got a situation where there's going to be some pretty tough questions to ask down the track. Some of those questions are already being asked around conditions and how things unfolded, but I think there's a lot of concern in the community, and that comes both from the Indigenous community and from the local police and from other community members, that there is a period of grieving called sorry business that is it should take time, and that the focus in that period should be on the life of a beautiful little girl. And that those other discussions will come down the track. You know, Jacinta Nampajimba Price, a coalition senator, she's a relative of the family and of the little girl. She wants to raise some of these issues now around what's happened in the town camps, whether there's a level of disadvantage and poverty that needs to be urgently addressed. And she has every, you know, political right to raise what she's saying. But I think many people who live in and around Alice Springs, who've engaged with these communities, have kind of appealed for a period of time where this can be just a time for the community to heal, rather than that big political discussion. There'll be a court case, there'll be a coronial inquest most likely as well, and there may well be other inquiries that come out of this. But at the moment, knowing what a small community Alice Springs is, and knowing how tiny many of the town camps are, these are very small groups of people. They feel very much in the public spotlight, and like they as a collective are to blame for what's happened. And I think that's made it really traumatic on top of everything else.
Okay, so we'll pause on that. Anna, in the few minutes we have left, I'd like us to speculate on the budget. I mean, I can't get enough of budget speculation. We've only got a week to go, but I have had leaked to me the most remarkable things about the budget. Second paragraph on page 3, I'm told, ends with a full stop. Have you heard that?
Well, David, I mean, it's top level stuff, isn't it?
It is top level stuff. I mean, we can guess about anything. We can get a front page story up by guessing about anything. I understand a large sum of money is going to be devoted to getting rid of feral cats. That's a pure guess on my part. I'd like to see it happen, of course. But why not speculate on the possibility that it's in the budget? Give us some speculation, Anna. You are a professional.
Do you know, in my experience, often those speculative stories, they haven't been pulled out of thin air. They're generally like fed into the system as, you know, what we call kite flying options. And the bigger the, you know, the potential budget impact, the more of a kind of kite flying option it might be, to check what the public mood is, so you can work out whether to quickly retract that brief from the cost cutting committee, or go ahead with it if actually it lands with the public. So I don't see a lot of budget speculation that's truly frivolous, but at the same time, I think sometimes the media is used by governments to kind of check whether something might, you know, fly or not. But in terms of my speculations around the budget,
yes.
Look, how far can we push out the idea of what is intergenerational fairness? It's such a broad concept. It can allow all kinds of suggestive policies. And the government has always said that in the end it wants to see everyone get a fair go. So
I mean,
at the same
honestly, I don't
think we're anywhere near. I'll tell you what I don't think will be in the budget, which I think is a sad thing in some ways, because it really was at the heart of the Labor agenda over two elections. It's that we live in a society where not only is there, you know, massive wealth inequality and that young people are absolutely struggling, but also where, you know, as we look to a potential additional interest rate rise, maybe tomorrow, maybe after the budget, and we know what the economic conditions could be as the year goes on, that we've created a society where, like, most families have two working parents and kids, you know, going through the school system, where, you know, I hear a lot from people, it's just incredibly hard for them to both pay their mortgage, look after their children and engage with them, and have, you know, a full life. And I think Labor has wanted to change the childcare arrangements and try to make it easier for people to live that life. But we've just constructed a society where it's very hard for that to happen. And I don't think Labor's got any appetite now to tackle that.
Well, the appetite is the hugest question, isn't it? What appetite does Labor have for change? Anna, thanks so much for joining us once again on Late Night Live. Anna, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS.